Thanks, Sean. I am Matt Lippman, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Chris, for asking me to speak. You know, I got asked, right, I guess when he got the commitment, and it's not, it's been tough, you know, sitting on this for a month, and, you know, what am I going to say, what am I not going to say, and I'm just really honored, though, to be able to speak here. This is my home group, and, you know, my sobriety date is 9/19/2004. My sponsor's name is Michael, and I'm currently working in step 9, and I live in 10, 11, and 12. And that's what's going on in my life. You know, that's really the gist of it right there. Those are the most important facts about my life today. And it wasn't always that way. You know, to tell you a little bit about what got me here, a few years ago, I can remember, you know, sitting around my apartment wondering, you know, should I, shouldn't I? You know, it was that same question that I always asked myself, you know, should I go out and drink again or shouldn't I go out and drink again? You know, the question would haunt me, and the pain of the phone calls from the day before telling me, you know, what I did and everything like that, it didn't do anything to stop me. You know, ultimately I went out and got drunk again. And that's what got me here. You know, from an early age, I can remember just never really feeling comfortable in my own skin. I went to a couple of different schools, and that probably didn't help very much. And my parents, you know, chose to move around a couple of times. And after they moved around a couple of times, I also, you know, wasn't doing very well. My grades weren't very good, and I was sent off to boarding school. And instantly, you know, as soon as I got to a strange place, I just would meet new people, and I just never felt comfortable around them. I always felt like I just didn't belong. And, you know, about somewhere in eighth grade, someone recommended that we go drink, and a couple of people, you know, older kids were going to drink. And I did, and you know, right from the second I took a drink, I felt like some kind of ease and comfort come over me that I had never felt before. And the kids that I was hanging out with, even though I was scared to go, all of a sudden, you know, they liked me. And I was, like, cool, and I was, like, good-looking around them, and I could accomplish anything. And that feeling, like, changed my life. I never had felt like that before. And I knew that all I wanted to do was chase that feeling. So from the time I was like a teenager until my early 30s, that's what I spent doing. I spent trying to chase that, what I perceived to be fun and what I perceived to be, you know, what made me who I could be, you know? Because when I was straight or sober, I really was always like uncomfortable, and I wanted to just be alone in my, you know, wherever I was, in my house, in my apartment, or my dorm room, wherever it was. But as soon as I got out and got drunk or, you know, did some dry goods, instantly I became a new man. And I always wanted those feelings. I just didn't like who I was, and I didn't like how I felt. So I knew that if I drank or did, you know, other substances, I could change my complexion. And you know, that proceeded, like I said, for about 20 years in my life. And what happened was, is it got progressively worse, and it stopped working. You know, I would have to drink more, and then I started blacking out, and, you know, it stopped being fun. And I was recommended to me that I should seek some help. And I didn't really fight the idea, because I was out of friends. I had, you know, gone through, you know, a lot of any money I had. I had no other relationships in my life. So I took the suggestion, and I went to see a psychiatrist. And this psychiatrist recommended that I get checked. He checked me into a hospital, that he admit me into a hospital, because he told me for the first time, you know, that he said, you're an alcoholic. You know, that's you're not mentally ill. You have, you know, alcoholism. And I was open to the suggestion, but I was like, the hospital thing, that's not going to work for me. You know, I got to go, I have to go to work, and, you know, people are going to, you know, they're going to miss me, and then I got to answer questions, and I'm not really interested in doing that. He said, all right, well, if you don't want to do that, then could you do me a favor and go speak to my drug and alcohol therapist? So I was open to do that, and I did that. And in my first session with him, he sat and he listened, and he reiterated, you know, what the psychiatrist said. He said, you're an alcoholic, and he said, you need to go to AA, though. And I was like, okay, yeah, you know, what's it about? And he's like, well, you know, you need to, you know, call information and get the number of intergroup and find out where a meeting is, and you'll learn. He's like, you know, and then come back next week and tell me how it is. So I came back the next week, and I was still drinking. And he's like, did you go to AA? And I said, no. You know, and I was like, okay. He's like, well, you know, I can't help you. He's like, you know, what you have is not a disease that is not something, you know, that I can help you with. And thank God for that therapist's, you know, lack of ego and the fact that he pushed aside his own agenda with me and recommended something to me. It turned out that he's been in the program for 18 years and he knew right off the bat. But, you know, the message there is that therapy will not fix this disease that we have. And you know, there's a story in the big book that says the same thing. And you know, God bless that man. Thank God. I did go to meetings. You know, I hear term used audited. I definitely audited meetings for like the first 6 months, and I didn't drink. But you know, I wasn't really open, and I didn't get any solution. I never bought a big book. I didn't, you know, I got a sponsor because I thought, you know, I could get some business from the person, not because of what, you know, what I could get out of the program. And I didn't take any of the suggestions that I heard mentioned in the rooms that I went to. And lo and behold, you know, on vacation, six and a half months later, you know, I was alone. I said I needed a week away from, you know, life. And I went away, and the first night I was there, I drank. And I was like, I won't tell anybody. No one will know. Well, I came back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not really a good place to lie about your sobriety. And I was really feeling even worse and miserable. So, you know, what happened was is I was just doing some controlled drinking when I went back to drinking, but that lasted only a couple of days because I said, why am I doing this? I might as well just go all the way. So, you know, sure enough, I ended up going right back to the way I used to drink and right back to blacking out. Well, on September 18th, I went to a concert at Madison Square Garden, and, you know, I did my usual nightly preparation, which was I started drinking right when I got out of the shower and I started getting dressed. You know, I lit my cigarette and I was getting, you know, all ready to go, and this whole routine. And sure enough, you know, I was basically drunk before I even left the apartment. I got to Madison Square Garden at this concert. There's bars in Madison Square Garden. I started drinking, and they do like a measured pour. So I was like, all right, just, you know, put six in a glass, like six measured pours. And I just drank it right down. And I don't even remember the concert. I ended up blacking out. I woke up the next morning, and there were firemen and policemen in the apartment that I had woke up in because they had to get to an upper floor. It was they were only waiting for them to get there because the elevator was down. They had gotten a fire alarm, was to get through, but it was a really bad thing to wake up out of a blackout from. And sure enough, I had to go back to AA, you know. And thank God, you know. I made one call, and this person recommended that I call their sponsor, and the guy told me to meet him. And for the first time, I was open to take direction, you know. And I went through the steps, and my entire life changed. So my message, you know, to the newcomer is that, like, take the suggestions, get somebody to work with, and work the steps. Your entire life will change. I was really fortunate that I had done this work just soon, you know, quickly enough that my dad passed away last year. And, you know, he got rapidly ill within a 2-month period, and he ended up passing away. But, you know, as a result of this program and having a higher power in my life, I was able to be a son for my mom for the first time. And, you know, I remember, you know, doing a 9-step amends to my dad, and the only thing he said, you know, at the end of the amends, my sponsor told me to ask when I do amends, you know, how can I make this relationship right? And when I did that with him, all he said was just, you know, stop messing with your mom. Just be a son already. And, you know, thank God he said that because, you know, I remembered those words as he was dying. And, you know, today I speak to my mom every day and I'm able to be a son for her. And this is like something you don't want to miss this, you know. This thing's, it's just the best thing in the whole world. So, thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Tara Q.
Hi, I'm Tara, and I'm an alcoholic. Eleanor, thank you for asking me to speak, and Matt, thanks. It was good to hear you. So the basics. My sobriety date is 7 October 2004. My sponsor is Martina. My home group is Atlantic Group, and I'm working steps 9 through 12. So just to do the math for you, I'm 28. I have a little over 2 years. And my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was when I was mandated by my high school to go to rehab in September of my senior year of high school. And I had been drinking for less than 2 years at that point. So for me, this disease was very progressive, very quick. And, you know, the years in between, I was in and out of the rooms for about 8 years. So I especially want to say to anyone who's just come in from a relapse, welcome. You are my mirror. It's good to be here and just try to stay and listen. Just to give you a little background, I grew up in Westchester. I come from an amazing family. My parents are, you know, they're my heroes, and I really mean that, as is my brother. And I grew up with a lot of love, very strict Irish Catholic family. But, you know, there wasn't anything in my childhood I could pinpoint this disease on. And my brother doesn't have it. And, you know, for me, I believe I was born with this disease, and it was kind of just waiting for me to pick up that first drink. Which I did when I was about 13 at a keg party in the woods, which anyone who's from suburbia will probably be familiar with. And, you know, I got drunk, and I didn't drink again for 3 years. I don't really know why. I was a really busy kid. I was in a lot of activities, and it just didn't really occur to me. And then in high school, I went to high school about 30 blocks north of here. You know, we all started drinking, and we were 14, and we could get IDs, and we could drink in the bars, and I, from the get-go, was worse than everyone else. I was a blackout drinker from the beginning. I was a messy, messy drunk. You know, I can probably count on one hand the times I remember or that I kind of held myself together. I was just a mess. And so I went to rehab, and I stayed clean for 8 months, but I wasn't doing it for myself. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I really had the notion in my head that you guys, you know, drank more than I spilled or whatever it is. And I did the steps, but, like, you know, half-heartedly. I remember typing them up so they looked perfect at the time, and my sponsor being like, oh, boy. You know, long story short, I was on a school trip that spring to Europe. I had one beer. I didn't tell anyone. I came back, and that summer I moved in with my boyfriend from the rooms. Big mistake if you're not sober. That relationship ended 3 years later with him smoking crack and hitting me almost every day, and me not eating and not going to AA and not drinking, and it was a mess. But by the time we broke up, I started drinking again, and it was amazing. And I really believe alcohol saved my life. It's my solution, not my problem, and it took me a really long time to get to that point. I am just as crazy not drinking as I am drinking if I'm not doing these steps. And, you know, so I drank. And the next 3 years, it got really messy really quick. I moved into the city. I wasn't accountable to anyone anymore. And I drank a lot with the people I worked with. And, you know, it was bad. And I couldn't. I thought because I was going to work every day and I made the bed every day, you know, and I kind of paid the bills sometimes, like it looked okay on the outside. Like you wouldn't necessarily look at me and realize that, you know, I was 25 and nearing late-term alcoholism. And at the end, my choices were basically, do I jump out the window or do I drink? And that's where this disease left me. I had been out of AA for about 7 years, and my best friend from high school actually had gotten sober. Miracle of all miracles. We both are today. And she brought me back to a meeting. And, you know, I came to meetings. I hung out. What I heard was meeting makers make it, which I will tell you my experience is that nearly killed me. I was going to 15 meetings a week, and I couldn't stop picking up, and I couldn't stop lying. And for me, the big change was finally getting honest. And, you know, I worked this program to the best of my ability. I had a great sponsor at the time who was taking me through the book, but I wasn't done yet. And I really believed I could outsmart this program. I picked up after about 8 months, and thank you. The next year was pretty much me going out once every 3 weeks or so. I was lying to everybody I knew. I would keep a journal at home, and I'd write down the days I had counted out loud and the days I really had, and it was crazy. I mean, I was chairing a meeting at a detox, and I would go in there and know that every person in that room had more time than I did, and here I was, like, repping AA. It was awful, and every single time I went out, I swore that would be the last time, and... You know, it's exceedingly difficult when your whole life has become AA and you have so many friends and people you love here, and I couldn't stop lying to anybody. And no one knew. I mean, I was qualifying, and people were like, you're doing great, and it was bad. And, you know, I'm really grateful for every single time I went out. Our book says, you know what, if you're not happy, go out and try some controlled drinking. And I had to do that. I had to realize that it just didn't work. My last night out was pretty much like any other night. I went out with people from work. My cousin Kevin was actually with me. His sister's here tonight. Meg, thank you for coming. I see you up there. And I remember being so mortified the next morning. I had about 60 people waiting for me at work to lead a meeting, and I was still, like, really drunk, and I just couldn't get it together. And I don't know what changed. When I had 2 days, my brother came into town, and then when I had 3 days, I called a good friend in the rooms, and I was like, I've been lying, like I need help. And, you know, that's where it kind of started for me. I quit my job about 2 months later. Some people will say no major changes in the first year. For me, not drinking is a major change, and I had to change absolutely everything. And, you know, I got into the steps. I got an amazing sponsor, Martina, thank you, wherever you are. And, you know, I just kind of did the deal. I went to 2 meetings a day. I did service. I prayed. I went through the steps or started to. And I got honest, and I stopped being so scared. And, you know, I didn't always want to be here, but this is a program of action, and it's not for people who are needed or wanted. It's for people that do it. And, you know, I did it then, and I worked so hard, and, you know, and then I got this life back, and I got to tell you, like, there's times now where I'm really not so interested in going to a meeting every night, and I'm not so interested in picking up that phone all the time, but, you know, I have to remind myself to do this, because if I don't, I'm dead, and it's very simple for me. Like, I know I don't have another relapse left in me, and I remember I would hear people say, I'm done, and I'm like, how do you know you're done? It's a day at a time. Like, don't tell me that, but I can't explain it, but when you get through these steps and you, you know, I'm not that girl that walked in here 2.5 years ago. I'm getting married in 5 months, which is crazy. And I'm so excited. But, you know, I was so, my walls were up so high and I wouldn't let anyone in. And I, you know, would run around saying, I'm not getting married until I'm 40. Like, I'm doing my own thing. And, you know, I get to show up today, and I don't do it perfectly, but I do it to the best of my ability. And I have to watch myself just as much today as I did 2.5 years ago, because this thing will come in so quickly. And, you know, it's not about drinking anymore. It's about living. And I have to stay spiritually fit every single day, or it all goes out the window. Oh, before I forget, I'm available to be a sponsor. My sponsor was like, don't forget to say that. So, you know, I do service. I need to pick up the phone more. But you guys really carried me, you know, and I know there's a few people in this room tonight that knew me when I was in and out, and thank you for standing by me. This was not the place where I first came to meetings, and so you guys didn't have the privilege of seeing me when I was really bad. But to those people that did, thank you for not giving up on me. And I love this home group. You know, I came in here kicking and screaming, and I hated it. I didn't want to be in a Protestant church. I didn't want to be in a happy meeting. And you know what? I did it. And if there's one thing I can tell you, it's, you know, don't listen to your head, listen to your feet, and just do what you're told. Like, I really had to sit down and shut up and listen. And, you know, some people don't agree with that, but that's what worked for me. Like, I had to stop whining and listen, and that's how I got better. So, anyway, it was great to be here. I'm deeply honored to be one of us, and thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you. My name is Alan. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 24th, 1984, and my home group is R2. My home group here in New York is the Mustard Seed 7:30 a.m. backroom meeting, and I have a home group in Connecticut, the Kent Village meeting on Friday nights. I have a sponsor. His name is Tom G, and I try and get to a meeting every day. Or every day that I can. Because after 23 years, I have found that what it says at the beginning of chapter 3 about people who've, like us, who have tried to drink like normal people, that the delusion that we can do so is astonishing, and many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. I've seen plenty of people die from drinking in my 23 years. I watched one of my sponsees die lying on his back in an SRO with an empty bottle of whiskey on his chest when the room clerk came up and got him. I saw my little sister die a couple of years ago. After she just didn't want to stop drinking, and they had to open her up for some kind of an operation. They opened her up, took one look at her insides and said, "We can't fix this lady." They sewed her back up, and she was dead in a couple of days. She had basically allowed alcohol to eat up all of her organs, and she died. So I take the program of Alcoholics Anonymous very, very seriously. I don't fool around with it. I think I have lost the obsession to drink, but you know what? Every once in a while, when a big problem comes my way, it's like a broken shoelace or a fight with my wife, I say to myself, you know, the way to deal with this is to just go out and get drunk. I had a great sponsor for many years. His name was Hal. Hal R., probably many of you met him over the years. He had over 40 years of sobriety when he finally passed away. And he taught me early on that when I had thoughts about drinking, that I should acknowledge them. I shouldn't brush them off. That I should think about them, think about what brought them on, look at them squarely, and then reject them. He said the worst thing I could do was to bury them. So I've always done that. And I have to confess, even after 23 years, that I still have the thoughts far more than I would like to admit. I started drinking. I grew up in Portland, Oregon, and I started drinking when I was about 12 or 14. I can't remember exactly when. I did what all kids do. I poured a bunch of booze from my father's liquor cabinet into a jar and took it off someplace and drank it down. And I have no idea how I felt afterwards. I don't know if I felt this great sense of well-being that we all read about people trying to chase for the rest of their drinking careers. I don't know that. I don't know if I blacked out. I don't know how I got home. I don't know anything. All I remember was drinking this booze, and that at one point I wanted to do it again. By the time I was 16, I'd already been thrown in jail for drinking underage and driving. I was a smart kid, albeit a fearful one and a shy one and a geeky, gawky kind of guy. But I got into a great college, an Ivy League college, and I left Portland and came back east and went to this college. And this was a school where everyone loved to drink. Way up in the country in New Hampshire, and there wasn't much else to do up there, I guess. Or at least so I thought at the time. It took me years and years to realize there was plenty to do. It's just that I wasn't doing it. By the time I had finished my sophomore year, I'd spent another night in jail and had paid a visit to the dean's office who suggested that I take a year off. And I did. I took my junior year abroad. I actually matriculated at a college in England and started to study, and it was great. Had great looking women there, lots of booze. There was a constant supply of something they called lager and lime, and when I'd mix the lime with the lager, with the beer, it seemed so much more polite. And so I drank. I was very polite. Always prided myself on my manners. And pretty soon, the University of Southampton dean called me in one day and suggested that I return to the United States on the next available ship. And so, so I got kicked out of there. And I bumped around. I came back to New York. I came to New York, and I lived here in New York on East 11th Street between A and B. And in those days, I'm an old guy. I'm 66 years old. In those days, at age 20, the Lower East Side was really the Lower East Side. There wasn't much going on down there. And there was an old bar on the corner of 12th Street and Avenue B called Stanley's Corner. And my pals and I took over this bar, and we convinced him to get rid of the Black Russian music that he had on the jukebox and put in John Coltrane and Miles Davis and Art Pepper. And it became Stanley's Bar on 12th Street became a kind of a mecca down there. And I was there every night. I loved to drink in Stanley's Bar, and a lot of other bars too, but I did it in Stanley's Bar. So I bummed around in New York. I was homeless for a while. I had a couple of friends who were adventurous, and we used to steal cars. In those days, General Motors cars didn't require a key if you turned them just to the off position. So we'd cruise the streets looking for cars that had only been turned to the off position. We'd get in the cars, turn it to the on position, and drive away. One time I drove away in a Chevrolet car, nice black Chevrolet, really, really great looking Chevrolet car, and we went out and got drunk, and drove it back into the city, and I thought, I'll look in the glove box, and I looked in the glove box, and it turned out that there was a police radio in the car, and this was a police cruiser that we'd stolen. My friend was driving at the time. When I told him it was a police cruiser, he said, I'm going to park this car, and he drove up on the sidewalk and crashed over a fire plug, and the water's shooting up out of the street from the fire plug, and we exited the police car in a hurry, but not before I took the officer's traffic tickets, and we wrote him a ticket for crashing over this fire plug. I knew that I didn't want to. I worked in the Marlboro bookstore on 42nd Street, and I didn't really want to be a bookstore clerk for very long. So the only skill that I'd had that I'd picked up in college was writing for the daily newspaper at college. And so I went to one of the wire services, and I, by some miracle, actually got hired as a wire service reporter. And I was immediately sent to Buffalo, New York. And I arrived in Buffalo, New York on January 6th, and it was something like 40 below zero, maybe 100 below zero, I'm not quite sure, but the wind was blowing off of Lake Erie, and there was a lot of snow up in Buffalo, and there's basically nothing to do in Buffalo except drink. So I did. And I drank for a couple of years steady in Buffalo, New York, and then got moved to New Hampshire. And it was equally cold and lonely in New Hampshire. And so I worked and I drank, and I worked and I drank. And that was how I spent my lives. I got girlfriends. I actually met a woman that I thought I was in love with, and she thought she was in love with me. Why, I'm not sure, because basically all I did with her was drink. But we got married. Seemed like a logical end to the brief romance. By this time, the wire service decided I was okay, and they were going to send me overseas. So I went first to the Pacific, and then I got transferred to Paris. And my wife and I moved to Paris. We had a great job there as a foreign correspondent. I did very well there. We had a baby there. Life went on. Mostly life went on drinking. Again, I drank every day. I don't remember ever going out to get drunk, but I was drunk a lot. I don't remember how I felt when I drank, but I still drank a lot. I just drank. I can't remember too many specific incidences of what happened to me when I was drinking, but I do. I have been able to reconstruct that every time I got into some serious difficulty, it was because I was drinking. If I was out covering some story in Africa or someplace in France, and I would get so drunk that I couldn't file my story. One of the other reporters on whatever the story was would actually phone it in for me because I was too drunk to do it. I would crash cars. I'd end up in bizarre places, bizarre beds, bizarre cities, and always those events were accompanied by booze. But I continued to do pretty well in my career, and eventually one of the clients of this wire service used to love to come to Paris, and he and I got to be very friendly, and he asked me to come back and be an executive in his news operation, so I did. We were pretty good drinking buddies, and I think he saw me as much as a drinking buddy as he did as an executive. But he moved my whole family back from Paris to the United States. And he gave me this great job, helped me to buy a house, helped me to get bank relationships, all the kind of stuff that you'd love to have a boss do for you. He did it for me. And I took this job only semi-seriously. What I did take very, very seriously was to continue to drink. And eventually, within a year or so, I drunk myself out of the job. But I still had this good name and this good reputation, and I was a young guy. I don't even think I was 30 years old at this point. But I got hired by this company to come up and run their office in New York as an editor. And I did. And I loved New York. I could drink just about any time. I could drink certainly anywhere. And I could drink as much as I want. I didn't have to worry about driving a car. I didn't have to worry about bosses. They were all in the corporate headquarters in the Midwest. Sex plays a huge role in my story. I won't go into all the the details, but suffice to say that one of the other things that would happen to me, or happen to other people most likely, when I was drunk, is that I would act out sexually. Didn't matter who the woman was. It could be my wife's best friend, and was. It could be her sister, and was. It could be the boss's wife, and was. It didn't matter. I when I was drunk, I was fearless and inconsiderate and stupid. Life went on. I would get I'd get plastered on a road trip someplace and be on my way to Des Moines and end up in Detroit. I would go on a business trip, and the first thing I would do would be to hole up in my hotel room someplace, order up a lot of booze and women, and never accomplish what I was set out to do on the business trip. How I kept jobs, I have no idea, but I kept them, and I kept getting better jobs. I would never have hired me. At one point, my wife had had enough of my womanizing and of my being drunk all the time. She was convinced I was by this time was a threat to our kids. We had two beautiful little girls, and she was very, very worried for their safety whenever I would put them in the car and drive somewhere, rightfully so. And she kicked me out of the house. I came home one night from wherever I had been, and I saw these two cardboard boxes in the front vestibule of this house. We'd lived in this beautiful brownstone over in Park Slope. And I said, "What are those boxes?" She said, "That's your stuff. They need to be out of here." And so she kicked me out. I had no place to live, so I moved into the most logical place, and I had no money. I moved into the most logical place, and that was the storeroom of my office. And I lived in the storeroom of my office for about a year until I got it together enough that I could find a place to live. And I'd go out again just about every night and get drunk. I lived, this office was in Murray Hill on 39th Street, and 39th Street between Lexington and Park has a lot of wrought iron fences. And the thing I most vividly remember about living there was not being able to walk on my two legs up 39th Street to this place where I was living in the storeroom, but having instead to hold on to the wrought iron fences, one fence post after the other, to get myself up to this place where I was living, and then crawl up the stairs on my hands and knees, unable to walk up just normally. I have no idea how I got that drunk. I mean, I had only ever gone out for a couple of drinks. As I say, I never went out to get drunk. I just did. I just did. When I started to drink, I had no control over how much I was going to drink or where I would end up. I met a woman, and we fell in love. And at one point, after a couple of years, she said, "Let's get married." And I said, "Are you sure you want to marry me?" And she said, "Yeah." I think she considered me a project. And we got married. And shortly after we got married, she said, "You're going to get in big trouble if we don't find something for you to do, especially on the weekends." So we bought a weekend home up in northwestern Connecticut in Litchfield County. And we bought this old tumble-down farmhouse, 140-year-old farmhouse. It had a heater on the a little furnace that heated the front or the first floor, but nothing up in the second floor where the bedrooms were. I did a lot of repairs to this house, of electrical repairs, plumbing repairs, always drunk. We later sold that house, and I've often wondered what the people who had to examine my electrical work must have thought. Who in the hell did this? One time, I was driving up there. The drive from New York to Litchfield County was always an adventure because I couldn't do it without having at least a six-pack of beer between my legs. And I would drink the six-pack on the trip up, often with my kids in the car. I figured out on the trip up, this particular trip up, how to heat the second floor. And I stopped at a hardware store on the way, and I bought a Black & Decker skill saw, one of those things that you go like this. And I took the Black & Decker skill saw up to the second floor when we arrived. This is after the six-pack in the car and however much else I was drinking. And I began cutting holes in the floor of each of the four rooms on the second floor. And then I realized that there was ceiling on the first floor, so I had to go downstairs and cut holes in the ceiling. Some of the holes were here, and the holes in the floor up there were there. But my wife was looking on in horror at what I was doing, and I explained to her very carefully that I remembered from school that heat rises. And that's how we got heat to the second floor. A few months later, it was evident that the heat wasn't rising, and I had to call in a carpenter to fix these holes in the floor. And years later, when we sold this house, we also had to put down wall-to-wall carpets in all those rooms up there. But years later, when we sold the house, they'd had to pull up one of the carpets, and I'd forgotten all about this incident until they pulled it up and pulled the carpet back. And there was this beautiful maple floor with a little 12 by 12 holes in it where it was a good reminder. Life went on like that, on and on. The womanizing continued. The missed appointments continued. The job advancements continued too for some reason. I still am in awe of that. One day, I know exactly what day it was. It was January 23rd, 1984. My wife had her own business, and she was having a big event for one of her clients at Mr. Chow's on 57th Street. And she said to me, "I'd like you to come to the event, Alan, but I do not want you to drink before you come. Please promise me you will not drink before you come, and go easy on the booze when you get here." So I said, "Of course I will." I promised. I was good at making those promises. I stayed at my office till about 12:30. My office was down on 45th Street. I figured, I'll stay at the office, then I'll walk up to Mr. Chow's, and I will be sober when I get there. But somehow, I stopped off and decided to have just a drink or two, and I decided that I figured out how I would not get drunk. I would drink single malt scotch, because if it was just single malt, I couldn't get drunk, because, you know, blended is what you get drunk on, right? So I don't know how many single malt scotches I had on the walk from 45th Street to 57th Street, but it was apparently enough, because when I arrived at her reception, they were serving, it was a big celebration of something or other, and they had a lot of champagne there, and they had a big round table in the middle of the main room there, and on this champagne on this table were bottles upon bottles of Krug champagne. In those days, I think it cost about $125 a bottle. I don't know how much it costs now, but it's probably a lot more. I sat on the table and upended it. And it was as if World War III had started. The crash was deafening. The broken crystal, dozens of broken crystal champagne flutes were all over the floor. All this champagne was on the floor. And the next thing I know, some guy is grabbing me by the arm and pulling me upstairs and out onto 57th Street. And it's my wife's partner. And he says to me, "I don't care what you do with your personal life, but you will not mess up this partnership. Get some help." A lot of people over the years had told me to get help. A lot of people had told me I had a drinking problem. But for some reason, I remembered what he'd said the next morning. And I got up the next morning and crawled out of bed and told my wife, "I'll be home late tonight." This caused not even a raise of an eyebrow, because I was home late every night. But she did say, "Why?" And I said, "Because I'm going to go to an AA meeting." And that day, I called Intergroup, and I said, "Where's the AA meeting in New York tonight?" And the lady on the phone said, "Well, where do you live?" And I said, "I thought this was an anonymous program. Why do you want to know where I live?" And so she explained why, and I told her approximately where I lived. And she said, "There's a meeting at a place called the Mustard Seed at 37th Street, right off of Lexington. Why don't you go there at 6:15? There's a beginner's meeting there." And I did. I went to that meeting at 6:15, and just like tonight, there are all these people that raised their hands and said, "I've been sober for 3 days. I haven't had a drink for 18 days. I haven't had a drink for 82 days. Every single one of them was lying, I said to myself. How could they possibly have not drunk for 82 days? It just didn't compute for me. But I stayed there for the whole meeting, and after the meeting, I left and was walking across the street to what was then called the Billy Budd Bar. A guy comes up and he hooks his arm around my arm and he says, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going home." And he said, "Well, I'll walk home with you." And he did. He walked home with me, and on the walk home, he said, "You know, I'm going to go to that meeting again tomorrow night. I'd love to see you there. And I hope you can make it. And all you have to do is just try not to drink tonight. Try not to drink tomorrow until the meeting." And so I said, "Okay, I will." I had no intention of doing that. I went inside. He was standing on the stoop in front of my apartment on 35th Street. And I got in the elevator, and my intention was to go in the elevator, go up, come down, and go back out and start drinking. And I said, "God, what if he's still there? What if it's the AA police?" So I went home instead that night, and I didn't drink that night. It's the first night, and I had a lot of booze in the house. It was the first night I can remember not drinking in ages. And I'd met the guy again the next night at the Mustard Seed. And we went out and had a cup of coffee afterwards, and he said, "You know, let's meet again tomorrow night." And we did. It turned out that this was a guy named Bob Weiss. He had 18 days of sobriety. And he died a year or so ago. He was still sober. We became running buddies. We kept each other sober in those very, very early days. So those of you who are new in sobriety and think you don't have anything to teach somebody else, you do, if you can stay sober one day at a time. Pick up a running buddy, and you both benefit. Anyway, my life went on. I've been able to stay sober since then. January 24th, 1984, my life has gotten enormously better. The woman that married me 31 years ago is still my wife. She was the one who didn't open her eyes when I said I was going to be back late that night. My kids are back in my life. I have three grandchildren, and my oldest grandson is named after me, which never would have happened if I'd been drunk. I owe everything in my life now to my sobriety and to AA, and I thank you all.